He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word.
In that I am using my King James Bible for the simple reason that the beauty and the language of Psalm 23 seems so appropriate or inappropriate being read from another translation. And I suppose it might be considered to be purely sentimental, and I'm quite sure it is. Someone was heard to say that if the King James Bible was good enough for St. Paul, it's good enough for them. And of course, the King James was not translated until 1611. By that time, St. Paul was already resting in glory. Psalm 23 is one of the most familiar passages known to saints and non-saints alike. I remember learning it in school when I was a boy. I remember hearing stories about the 23rd Psalm. I remember going to movies and when soldiers were going through difficulties and the time at departure was come, that they would repeat the 23rd Psalm. I've heard of people who were going to the gallows. They were heard to say the 23rd Psalm. And one of the most disturbing things to me about this psalm is this. A great number of people see Psalm 23 as a psalm needed in times of death. And nothing, my friends, could be further from the truth. Psalm 23 is a psalm of life. Death does not enter into the psalm until you get to the last verse in which it is anticipated. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, present tense. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever, future tense. So that the psalm has to do with having our feet, having our heads, having our hands firmly planted, rooted on earth, where we go through situations that are equal to death, but at which time we have the shepherd with us. Charles Spurgeon calls this psalm the pearl of the psalms. No language used by human beings can fully appreciate the theme, the grandeur, the movement of the psalm. We are so used to it, and therefore my prayer that God will help us not to see it as something we have been brought up with, and therefore what new can come from this psalm? I trust that in the words of what they say at a marriage, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue might be here this morning. And blue talking about the sky, not the nature, and so on. So turn, if you please, to Psalm 23. And as I was preparing this psalm, I said to Pastor Hamilton, I can't go through the whole psalm this morning. I leave on Wednesday for Calgary, and I would be here until Wednesday. It is a great psalm. I'm not exaggerating. If one were to take time to go through this psalm, even as Spurgeon went through it, it would take a longer time than 25 minutes, I can assure you. It is a great psalm. And so I said to him, I will go through it 1 to 3 this morning, and then 4 to 6. Lord's willing, on the 5th day of August upon our return. What is unique about this psalm is the quietness it brings to our soul when it is repeated or even thought about. And one must ask him or herself, what is behind the quietness, the sense of repose when we come to the psalm? I think it can be said in one word, and the word is relationship. Psalm 23 is a hymn of relationship. It is singing out to God with a deep sense of appreciation for the great privilege of being related to the one who made heaven and earth. And I ask you, as we go through this psalm this morning, to ask God to clear your mind of everything you might know about it. And even if you hear something that you know, that it might become fresh. Someone once asked someone, what is the best state to live in? And the reply came, the best state to live in is the state of contentment. Paul said, I've learned in whatever state I am in. And that was not talking about the United States, please. It's talking about the nature of life, the experiences of life, whatever situation I find myself in, I have learned, and note that word, I have learned how to be content. And if any civilization is restless, it is this one. It is this one. I heard yesterday morning of someone who was late for work on the 401 and got so mad that he got out and beat the person ahead of him because he was late for work. Wow. That's one reason Pastor Hamilton and I try to get here at 7:30 in the morning. That time, we don't stop anybody. I want you to consider with me, first of all, the contentment of the Christian life. The contentment of the Christian life. This is why this morning's theme is the advantage of being a Christian. The advantage of being a Christian. What is contentment? Contentment is to live in the midst of with a sense of absolute confidence in tomorrow. Unruffled. Unruffled. Psalm 23 begins this way. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The contentment of the Christian life. Contentment, my friends, is based upon two great truths. The first of them is the affirmation of faith. The affirmation of faith. Notice how David begins his psalm. He begins it by stating a fact, the Lord. He doesn't begin with his experience. He begins with an affirmation of faith that in life, in spite of the fact that he lived on earth, that he lived as a shepherd, he is absolutely confident that beside him there is someone else in the world, and that someone else is called the Lord, and he is rightly related to him. We must ask ourselves the question as we think of the affirmation of faith, who is this Lord? I think I told you the story of several years ago when I was contemplating becoming an evangelist. I went to New York City, to Brooklyn, in fact, and I went to see a man by the name of Tom Skinner. And I walked into Mr. Skinner's office, and he reminded me of Goliath. I mean, I think he is about 6 feet 11 inches tall, and he was at that time 240 pounds. Please remember that at that time I was not married and weighed 121 pounds. And I walked into Mr. Skinner's office. And as the man rose from his seat, I looked up to him, and inside of me went, wow, sir. It was a sense of awe. It really was. Here was this giant of a man, and here was Charlie Brown beside him. And I hardly knew what to say. But he made me feel right at home as he greeted me, calling me by my first name. Think of it, friends. David could look up to heaven, and he could call God by his name. For you see, the Lord is his name. Jehovah Yahweh. That's from which we get this word, our English word translation of it. Jahweh. Jehovah Yahweh. The Lord. But who is the Lord? The word, my friends, comes from a Hebrew word which tells us of being. It speaks of God's self-existence. It speaks of God as having being within himself. If you please turn to Acts chapter 17 and verse 24, so we can get somewhat of an explanation of what it means when we use the word Lord, and when David said Lord, just precisely what he meant. Acts chapter 17, verse 24. God, that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is the Lord of heaven and earth, this God, who is the Lord, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Paul is trying to get the people of Athens to understand the immensity of God. He's trying to get them to understand that God cannot be contained within the confines of a building. So he does not dwell in temples made with hands. Neither is worshipped by men's hand. In other words, God is not upheld by the hands of men. My friends, if all the world were to worship God, if all the world, 5,500,000,000 people would become Christians today, it wouldn't add anything to the glory and the existence of God. You see, God has life within himself. He is not propped up by anything or by anyone. He's not worshipped with men's hands as though he has need of anything. The word need is a human word. It is not a divine word. I hear people say sometimes God created us because he needed someone to fellowship with. My friends, if God has need, then God ceases to be God. God never has a need. He desires and he wills, but he never has needs. You and I have needs. David had need. Make that plural, needs. Seeing he giveth life to all and breath to all things. He gives life to all and breath to all things. I remember hearing the story of an atheist who walked through Washington Park in New York. And he was parading up and down that there was no God, there was no God, there was no God, there was no God. And so he got up in his soapbox and he told people, I'm going to prove to you that there is no God. And he got in his soapbox and he said, God, if you are there, strike me down right now. 5 minutes went by, 10 minutes went by, an hour went by, and he still was standing. And he said, see, I just proved to you that there was no God. And an old gentleman walked up and said, I want to tell you a little story. As I was walking through the park just now, a little chap came and he kicked me. Now, I could have turned around and broken every bone in his body, but I am a lot bigger and smarter than the little kid. And I would look like a fool to take it out on him. You see, God doesn't have to show fools that he exists by striking them down. He exists whether the fool believes it or not. God, my friends, does not have to prove anything to anybody. He can strike whoever down he wants to, but he's bigger than that. He's bigger than our foolishness. He gives life to the atheist, to the agnostic. He gives life to the saints and to the sinners alike. He is the Lord. And David affirms this by saying, the Lord, the one who gives life, the one who is the Alpha and the Omega, the one who has the A and the Z within his, all his, the immensity of himself, this God is my shepherd. Who runs your life? Who is the one who has under control every circumstance of your life because he knows the end from the beginning? David said, the Lord is the one who has absolute control, for he's dealing with with shepherd's language. He sees this God as a personal God, so personal, so intimate, that he could become fully acquainted with him and express himself to God as a sheep and a shepherd. No wonder in Psalm 8 he says, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. When I consider the heavens, the moon and the stars, which your little finger has made, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you should visit him? Oh, my friends, here is this personal relationship that brings contentment. That God, who has life within himself, is personally related to me. And it's interesting to me, and I must get going here, that David sees himself as a shepherd. Shepherds were not people who were well thought of, where David was. Only within Jerusalem was a shepherd thought of to be anything of importance. Outside of that, they were the, if you please, the janitors of their day. And I can say that because I was once a janitor. I was once a garbage man as well, in fact. But that's the kind of people that this Lord comes to. The people who are willing to respond to him as he reveals himself to them. Well, so much for David and that affirmation of faith. But I want you to see, secondly, not only the affirmation of faith in this contentment of the Christian through personal relationship, I want you to understand the audacity of faith. The audacity of faith. Webster says of audacity, audacity is where one has a bold, arrogant disregard for the normal things of life. I love that. If you're an audacious person, you have a bold, arrogant disregard for the normal things of life. Listen, my friends, that's precisely what Jesus said as the good shepherd to the apostles. Take no thought for your life, what you shall eat, what you shall drink. I mean, that's life, isn't it? That's a bold disregard for the normal things of life. Look at what David said. The Lord is my shepherd. My shepherd. Not a shepherd. Not the shepherd, but my shepherd. In other words, my friends, we have the I-thou relationship here. That life is made up of a relationship, whether in heaven and earth, heaven, earth, and earth, or earth and earth. Life is made up of relationship. I've only met one person in my entire life who didn't like music. One person. And he was the most miserable fellow I ever knew. He was. See, music speaks of relationship, and David is singing a song to God. The Lord is my shepherd. He's my companion. He is my divine friend. This is the audacity of David to call God, who has life within himself, his divine friend. Jesus climaxed this for us, my friends, in John 10 when he says, I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. Jacob understood something of this in Genesis chapter 49. He speaks of God who will shepherd his people. Let me ask you this morning, in the trials of life, can you say that the Lord is your shepherd? That there is a divine destiny behind every duty of life that I do from time to time, day by day? That I am not just someone passing through time, but in time I have a divine relationship with the unseen hands that are as real as those hands that are seen. I went to visit Vera this past week, and her voice is fading. And as I whispered to her a few things, she said, I didn't think I would be here for this week. I thought, listen to these words, I thought the Lord was going to call me home. home. That beyond the sky, there is a home for those who can look into the sky and say, the one who made it all is my divine companion. My friend, what an audacity. I mean, can you imagine me saying? I sometimes say it jokingly, of course. The phone would ring and I would say, tell Brian I'm not in right now. Oh, what does Brian want with me? Or when it was Pierre, I'd say, tell Pierre I'm not in right now. Or tell George I'm not in right now. As humorous as that is, my friends, wouldn't it be wonderful if I had a direct line to the White House? Or to 24 Sussex? Or to number 10 Downing Street? You would all know it. It wouldn't be a secret. Probably charge you a dime just to come and pass by my house. But more than that, my friends, the one who made it all, who gave life to those that we count worthy of our peering when we see them, the one who gave life to everything that breathes, that God says he wants to become our companion. He wants to. It's a choice that God has made. It's not a need in his nature. It's not a flaw in his character. David had experienced something of existence. And from existence, he realized that nothing can exist unless someone is responsible for it. And by searching in the movements of God's grace in his heart, he came to understand that one who became his shepherd. So that's the personal relationship that brings contentment. But secondly, there's a personal, not only personal relationship, it's what I call practical reasoning. Practical reasoning. Now, nothing could be further from the truth that when Christians become, when we become Christians, that we leave our intellect at Calvary. We never think again. We never use our minds. No, friends, that is not Christianity. Christianity is rooted and grounded in knowledge. And this is what David is saying. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Reasoning. Reasoning. He is my shepherd, I shall not want. Now turn quickly. I think perhaps David got this from Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 7. Deuteronomy chapter 2. God is speaking to the people through Moses. And he said to them in Deuteronomy 2:7, for the Lord thy God hath blessed thee in all the works of thy hand. He knoweth thy walkings through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord thy God hath been with thee. Thou hast lacked nothing. Thou hast lacked nothing. The word lack and the word want are the same Hebrew word. And it is speaking, my friends, of being left destitute. Of being left without or failing at certain points in life. David said, because the Lord is my shepherd, there is not a point in my life that I shall ever be in want destitutely. To be left without. God has ways of caring, dealing with our own personal needs because he is the Alpha and the Omega. And those who put their trust in him can say, because the Lord is my shepherd, I shall never be destitute, neither in life nor in death. Let me quickly go on and read something Francis Schaeffer wrote in How Should We Then Live? I want you to hear it from the heart and the lips of a man and the pen of a man who walked with God until God called him home just recently. He writes concerning the economy. He said, modern society's inability to find a solution for the problem of inflation without causing economic recession opens the door wide for economic breakdown. Each cycle of inflation, attempted controls, the threat of economic recession, and finally released control has increased inflation. Yet politically, with most people dominated by the concept of an ever-expanded affluence, it is difficult if not impossible, to face the danger of economic recession. Thus, each threat of economic recession opens the door for the next higher state of inflation. At a certain point, economic breakdown is hard to resist. In other words, my friends, listen to the politicians as they speak. I listen to them almost every day. If the dollar goes up, it affects the way we sell our goods abroad. If it goes down, we get too cheap. We sell our stuff for too cheap. If we get a zero employment, it can affect the economy. If we have too high unemployment, it can affect the country. Either way we go. We had an experience the other night, and someone asked me, are you getting sermon materials out of this? I said, no, but I have it as an illustration. So here it goes. We're all involved in a meeting gathering Friday night. And I sure hope that they don't mind me using their name. And as Dave and Llewellyn made their way home, as they got to the street where they lived, there are all the police cars. Here are the reporters. Here, my friends, the ambulance. Here, my friends, the police squad unit surrounding Dave and Llewellyn's house. They were not there. The children were, though. The police went to the door and knocked at the door and tell the kids, get in the basement and stay there. And good kids as they were, and I mean that sincerely, they did just that. Because when Dave could not get in, and I stood at the phone with Dave at Sunkist Plaza, and he was calling, the phone rang about 20 times. Now, I wasn't counting, he wasn't counting, but it seems like 20 times. When the whole thing was finished and we went to the house, Owen said, the phone rang about 20 times. I thought, well, the Lord must have been guiding that one. And here, my friends, they could not get in to see their children. There was someone with a gun held up on the other side. What do you do when the bottom falls out if you don't have a Lord who is your shepherd? How do you face the police saying you cannot go into your own house? Your children are there. My friends, you must commit them to one who is all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful, and that is the Lord. That's why David could say, I shall not want. To be kept, my friends, from anxiety and stress and difficulties with an uncertain future, with the police around you, with a man with a gun next to your children, what do? You look into heaven and you say, the Lord is my shepherd. Are you concerned? Of course you are. Of course you are. But I want to tell you, my friends, what doesn't happen. You don't become victim to the circumstances because the Lord is your shepherd. May I hasten to say, because you have good Christian friends who also come and share with you. Practical reasoning. And the Lord Jesus Christ did the same thing to the disciples. He said, take no thought for yourself what you shall eat, what you shall drink, or the clothing. Look, he said, and the birds of the air, they don't go through life worrying about tomorrow, and God feeds them. He has counted every hair on your head. The Gentiles seek after these things, but you trust in the Lord. He's your shepherd. He's my shepherd. I can trust him. Well, let me quickly go on. From the contentment of the Christian life, because, my friends, it is based upon a personal relationship. It is based upon practical reasoning. Christianity is not something where you have your head in a cloud somewhere. I used to hear people say, some Christians are so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good. There are some like that, but I tell you, the only way you'll be earthly good is if you're heavenly minded. In the practical sense. Look at the controlling of the Christian life. The controlling of the Christian life. Psalm 23, verses 2 and 3. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He restores my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Let's look first of all, under the controlling of the Christian life, at what I call the procedure of control. How does God, the shepherd, control? What procedures does he use to control our lives? David gives it to us. We have it. First, he maketh me to lie down. Now, we like to dwell upon green pastures. Of course. There's a certain part going up to Stainer Camp that is so beautiful. I look forward to seeing it all the time. It reminds me of the beautiful pastures out in Alberta when I was living there. Always look forward to being there. You feel you could just stay there and watch. But that's not what life is made of. Life is made of the real stuff. And that's what David is saying. Listen to what he says. He maketh me. Remember what I said about St. Paul? St. Paul said, I have learned. Contentment, my friends, is a learned art. It's not automatic. Because I'm a Christian, it doesn't mean that things are going to be rosy from here on. It means that I will have to go into God's school, into God's construction garage, and have God make me. The word literally means to yield. God chips away at those things which are so natural to you and to me until he makes us, until we willingly comply with God. As David said, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I delight in your law. He maketh me to lie down. I was talking with my mother this morning. She called me. She said, I wanted to say hello to you just before you leave for church. And we got talking, and for some reason, she started to remember the days when she used to beat me. And she said, it was all I could do because I didn't want my children to go astray. And I started to recall some of the things, you know. My brother was 21 when he got his last licking. I was 16. And the major crime I committed was that I went to a basketball game without telling my mother where I was. And mother said, I'm not giving you a licking because you went to the basketball game, but because you went as though you were your own person. See, where I was born, the way I was reared, 9 o'clock was a privilege when you were 21. He makes me. And my friends, as I stand here this morning, I could see her almost through the phone, and I could almost say, thank you. Thank you. She has made me. You know, I the first school I went to, I said to Pastor Hamilton, I won't get the first three verses. I might not get the one verse. I went to a school, my friends, the first school I went to. There was no dating. Boys and girls didn't sit together. They went through different doors. When you got the privilege of eating together with girls at noon, it was a rare privilege. You had to be in bed by 10 o'clock. You had to be up by 6. You had to do certain work. That's where I was a garbage man. My first job on the college campus was to wash pots and pans. Discipline was required. And students all around me complained about it. And my friends, I can stand here this morning and I can say to you, I had no reason to complain because I had learned discipline from my mother. And so when the Lord wanted to bring me into a certain place to make me, he had help from mom. And he could make me. I could remember times when I put my hand to my side and my head and my pillow, and I knew what God wanted me to do. He wanted me to lie down. But he had to make me before I would. He had to level me. He had to bring me to the place of yielding. One of the things I didn't want to do at all in the 23rd Psalm, I didn't want to go to any book. I didn't want to go to any commentaries or anything. And I always refrained myself. I went to the Hebrew text. I went to my dictionaries. But I did not go to any books except I said, I must go to Phil Keller for this one thing. Because he was a shepherd. He knows it quite well. And I wanted to learn something. I knew it because I had read the book before and I had the privilege of being taught, if you please, by Phil Keller. One class, he lived on the same campus where I was. And Phil Keller has four things about a sheep before a sheep would lie down as a shepherd that he discovered. One, he said a sheep will never lie down unless it is free from fear. The sheep must have inner tranquility that there are no dangers lurking around. That's what the sheep has to feel. A sheep will not lie down unless it is free from fear. A sheep will not lie down unless it is free from friction. Friction. You know the little things that irritate you in life? Like the guy on the 401? A sheep will not lie down unless it is free from pressure or stress. A sheep will not lie down unless it is free from hunger or want. Fear, friction, stress, hunger. He makes me to lie down. Where does God have you this morning? Or where are you? Is he making? Are you, my friends, in a grip of fear? Are you, my friends, in a grip of friction? Is there tension within the family that you cannot lie down, you cannot feel? I remember Howard Hendricks saying, and I was repeating this to Pastor Hamilton the other day, some ministers go to the office not because they love to study, but because they cannot stand the pressure at home. Oh, may God save us from looking for escape outside of himself. Friction. Pressure. Stress. Oh, we can say much about that. From hunger. The controlling of the Christian life, he makes me to lie down. And perhaps, my friends, one reason why some Christians are unhappy is because they're failing to yield to the disciplines of God to make them lie down. You might be struggling with an issue in your life, as I did, one with mine. And you're not lying down, you're not contented, you can't lie down. The green pastures are something you hear about, but not something that is true of you. If you will yield this morning, God will make you to lie down. Let me close with the introduction of our closing hymn. Number 364. Joseph Gilmore was walking home one night from Bible study, in which they were studying the 23rd Psalm. And says, Mr. Gilmore, I became so overwhelmed with the fact that the Lord is my shepherd, that he leads me, that I put pen in hand and paper, and I started to write. And I wrote, he leadeth me, O blessed thought, O words with heavenly comfort fraught. Whate'er I do, where I be, still 'tis God's hand that leadeth me. He leadeth me, he leadeth me by his own hand. He leadeth me, his faithful follower I would be, for by his hand he leadeth me. He gave it to his wife as a memento. She sent it to the publishing company, and we have it in our book today. And thankful we are that she did. For he closed with his hymn, we close his service this morning, reflecting upon this Lord who is our shepherd, who leads us, who makes us to lie down. And Lord's willing, we shall continue this upon a future date. 364.